Hello and welcome to The Third Degree. I'm Libby.
And I'm Jess. And on today's show, we'll look at government radioactive waste policy, carbon offsets and green jobs.
But joining us in the studio now is Hannah Walters. Hello, Hannah.
G'day, everyone.
And Hannah's just come back from a massive road trip to the Northern Territory, where she went for a big convergence of people from all across Australia who are all there protesting against the continued intervention that's happening up there. So, Hannah, tell us a little bit about the convergence and why it was happening.
Basically, it was the most amazing experience of my life today.
Oh, wow.
Which is a pretty big call, but I'm not the only one who thought so. There were about 200, 300 plus people who came from every single state around Australia.
Oh, wow.
We converged on Alice Springs, the red centre of the country, at the invitation of local Indigenous people in the area who were really outraged about this intervention. The reason we all went up there last week was the government was set to release a review. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be on Tuesday, and we had a massive, massive community rally in the centre of Alice. We walked 3 kilometres from the centre after having a huge speak out. We walked to the gap, we closed the gap, and Aboriginal people in the prescribed areas got to tell their story, and we got to be there in solidarity and to sit and listen.
Oh, wow. Can I ask what this prescribed area means? Like, who
yeah,
are these
sure.
people?
Well, the intervention, it's a Commonwealth government legislation, which is targeting Aboriginal people, but targeting them in specific locations. Their label is prescribed area. I think the latest count is 97 of these Aboriginal towns called prescribed areas. These people are experiencing 50% of their money is being quarantined. They're being forced onto ration cards, so they're only allowed to spend some of their money at particular shops, sometimes up to 300 kilometres away.
Can I ask how many people were there? I know that some media reports said only 100 people were at this main rally.
Yeah, we got that paper the next day and we went there just so out of it. It was at least 200 people from around the country. And then there were a lot of locals. A lot of people also came in from prescribed areas, so they were just in Alice Springs for the day. There was easily 300, 400 people marching in the streets in protest of the intervention.
Yeah, it seems so far removed in a way from what everyone else is experiencing that it's really hard to get a sense of what it's like. And I think that's sort of one of the problems with the intervention is that people living in the cities, don't really have a lot of chance to sort of interact with people and actually find out what it's like. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about, what it was like getting to speak to people who are living this every day and what some of the more telling stories were that you got to hear?
We stayed with the amazing Auntie Barbara Shaw, at her place in Mount Nancy, which is just on the edge of Alice Springs. Got to sit down with her family, meet her kids, meet her neighbours. We got to hear so many stories about people having their money quarantined, or their grandmother can't have access to vegetables that week because she hasn't got a car, and so she just sits because that's all she can do. So it was really eye-opening. We also were lucky enough to visit a few of the other town camps around Alice Springs and speak to some of the most amazing, resilient and struggling elders, and also some of the young people. A crew of people from the convergence also got to go up to Yundamu, which is an Aboriginal township about 300 kilometres north. So there's some amazing footage and stories from that. And we're planning, because it is such a big thing for, city slickers like me to go and do, we really want to share our experiences with everyone. So next Monday, which is, I think it's the 13th of October, we're having a big report back forum at, I think, the Footbridge Theatre at Sydney Uni. Be there at about 6, I think. Then we'll get the show on the road.
You mentioned about on the protest day that you closed the gap. What did you mean by that?
So just outside of the main town of Alice, there's this amazing, quite sacred actually, rock formation where these big mountain ranges, instead of just continuing, they actually, there's a big gap, there's a big road between them, that's obviously modern, but it's the mountains just end and you can walk through it. So, there's the health campaign, close the gap. So we sort of appropriated that, closed the gap between the unfairness between, Indigenous and non-Indigenous experiences and social systems. So the 300 or 400 of us sort of marching together, we went to this gap in the mountains and effectively said, the intervention is not acceptable. We're going to go to any means we can. We're going to show Alice, show the world that we're really serious about protesting the intervention.
Now, you mentioned that that protest or this the whole trip was originally organised because there was a review of the intervention plan. That's actually been pushed back till the middle of October. Do you think that's in part because this convergence was planned?
I think the government is a bit scared of, you know, there's resistance, there's people power, there's grassroots communities all across the Northern Territory and across other states who are very anti-intervention. So even if the government's moved their review, this is just the beginning of the protest, really.
What else has come from this? Are there plans? What are the plans in the future?
I think the group in Alice Springs, the Rollback the Intervention group, still going strong. They're looking at ways to continue connecting to affected, continue talking to affected communities. They've actually just launched, this is exciting news, up in Darwin, they've launched a challenge to the intervention against the High Court, saying that it's an illegal act against breaching the Constitution. So that happened, a couple of days ago. So people are sort of taking legal direction. Then there's people going back to their sort of cities all around the country, doing report back meetings, doing film screenings, sort of thinking about how non-Indigenous Australians and people who are away from the territory can support the struggles there. There's thinking of monthly sit-ins at Centrelink offices. There's going to be maybe a couple more street rallies, all sorts.
Hannah's going to stick around with us because this next story is also happening in the Northern Territory. With the ALP election promise to repeal the Commonwealth Radioactive Waste Management Act, you'd be forgiven for thinking that debate over a nuclear waste dump in the Northern Territory is no longer relevant. However, nearly a year into the Rudd government's term, this act is still in place. 2 weeks ago, the Greens Senator Scott Ludlam introduced a bill to repeal this act. And the Third Degree's James Hitchcock spoke with Senator Ludlam.
Yeah, well, what we're repealing is the Act of Parliament that Howard rammed through the Senate at the end of 2005, which essentially overrode all relevant Northern Territory legislation in order to dump, you know, to set up a radioactive waste dump for Australia's sort of 50-year inventory of nuclear waste from Lucas Heights and from other sources. And at the time, it was opposed very strongly by the Labor opposition, by the Greens and Democrats, and indeed by the Territory government and the local community. And the Labor Party said they would repeal it. It's been nearly a year, and it's time that that happened.
Now, the legislation is currently before Parliament. What happens now?
Well, what happens from now is late last week it was referred to a Senate committee, and so that's a fairly normal process for bills that are not run-of-the-mill, is that a Senate committee investigates and takes evidence from community groups, government departments, and anybody else who expresses an interest. And even though this is a private senator's bill that's not likely to be supported by the government in the short term, there will still be that Senate inquiry, and so I'm really strongly encouraging people to make a submission, whether they live in the territory or not, and advise the government. This is sort of one narrow little opportunity that people have to let the government know what they think should become of Australia's radioactive waste.
There was obviously a bit of controversy around the actual levels of community consultation that happened around the Waste Management Act. Do you think this new inquiry will help give communities a chance to actually have their say a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it will provide a bit of a focal point. And we were very critical at the time that without any consultation whatsoever, Howard just rammed this through because essentially the territory overall is constitutionally vulnerable. And it was something that Howard was able to just force through the Senate. And I'm very worried, I suppose, that Minister Martin Ferguson, see, they took it out of the science portfolio and put radioactive waste in with industry, which is a very strange thing to do. But in the meantime, Ferguson's just really continued on the path that Howard was travelling down of zero consultation. They're not talking to anybody. And no one can figure out what it is that they're doing. So this is one opportunity that people can have to make their voices loud and clear.
Now, it's interesting that you say that. Martin Ferguson is, I guess, considered someone who's slightly more pro-nuclear in the Labor Party. He's previously said he supports, you know, the selling of uranium to China and whatnot. Why do you think the act has been transferred to Mr. Ferguson's portfolio?
Yeah, I think it's a real shame. I think Prime Minister Rudd has just given it to Ferguson in order to keep it out of the headlines and to prevent any due process from happening. What we wanted to see earlier on this year was that should have been repealed, and then there should have been an open and transparent and consultative process to determine what should become of the nation's radioactive waste. That was what was promised. That was what was in the ALP policy. And instead what I think is happening is Ferguson is trying to lock in a dump site in the territory, probably at Muckatee Station, not far from Tennant Creek. And once they've got that locked in and legally binding, then they'll repeal after it's too late for people who have done anything about it. And that's a thoroughly dishonest approach. That's not what Labor's policy was.
I contacted the Minister for Resources and Tourism, Martin Ferguson, and asked him if the government still plans to hold strong on its election promise to repeal the Commonwealth Radioactive Waste Management Act, and if the Muckatee site was still up for selection. His office replied, "The government is committed to repealing the Commonwealth Radioactive Waste Management Act. The studies being completed in the Northern Territory represent the finalisation of the contractual obligations entered into by the previous government. Site investigations have been consistent with the agreements entered into between previous government and traditional owners of the land and with the site investigations contractor, Parsons Brinkerhoff. The government has not made any decisions on the site for a radioactive waste facility and no decision on the location of a radioactive waste repository will be made without the proper consultation with state and territory governments, indigenous and local communities, or without proper scientific assessment of the sites."
And that was the Third Degree's James Hitchcock speaking with Senator Scott Ludlam. And last week on the Third Degree, we heard that a uranium exploration licence has been granted for the Angela Pamela site, just 25 kilometres from Alice Springs. Hannah, you were in Alice Springs at the time of this announcement. What would you say the sentiment of locals is towards this announcement and also to uranium mining?
Well, it was a really shocking announcement, actually. I think we heard it the day of or just before the big rally in Alice Springs. Wow. And because it was a gathering of people from all over country in Northern Territory, there were actually some people from Angela Pamela there. This one woman spoke out at the end of the rally and really passionately brought a lot of people to tears, just saying there's such strong community opposition for uranium, like just leave it in the ground. Mm. It's the overwhelming consensus. So it was really powerful to hear it from the people who are, you know, it's just down the road from them. There's a big, actually it's sort of an environment action collective that's really strong against this. There's been, like there was a snap action the day afterwards, so in Alice Springs with about 20 to 50 people hassling the sort of government officials responsible. There was going to be a big rally on Sunday. Mm. Yeah, so this collective is going to be working strong.
So during the convergence, there were a lot of opportunities to also talk to people who've been affected by uranium mining and waste dumps that are in the area.
Yeah, definitely. In the report just by James, he mentioned Muckatee Station and Tennant Creek. There were actually some Indigenous mob from there in Alice at the time. There's this amazing woman called Diane Stokes who's been sort of the voice of her community and just saying that, you know, uranium mining is linked hand in hand to taking away Aboriginal rights, to taking away Aboriginal connection to country, and that's all linked to the intervention. It's all just one massive land grab from either a social perspective or greedy mining perspective. So yeah, everyone's talking about it.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Hannah.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I hope that I can come back and share more stories in the next couple of weeks because so much is going on in the territory. I want to keep telling people in the cities.
Back to people living in the city. You may ride a bicycle to work and you might have switched to green power at home without realising that there are other ways that you can reduce your carbon footprint. More than 50 carbon offset schemes exist, but how do you find what project is sustainable for you? Carbon Offset Watch is a website that ranks Australian carbon offset retailers, and Anna Von Fan spoke to one of its founders, Dr. Chris Reedy, from the Institute of Sustainable Futures.
It's the first process in Australia that's actually assessed and ranked carbon offset retailers. We started work on it around a year ago now, and it was launched just recently in September. There is an international process called Carbon Catalogue that has ranked carbon offset retailers, but doesn't use as detailed and rigorous approach as we have.
What is the main purpose of the website?
It's got a couple of purposes. The main one, I guess, is to help consumers who want to do the right thing and reduce their emissions, offset their emissions, to really cut through the complexity of the voluntary carbon market and get some independent advice on who the best retailers are to offset your emissions with. So there's many retailers out there and they offer very different products and services, and it can be very hard for a consumer to make sense of that, so we've tried to make it easy for them. But the other purpose is to try and influence the federal government to bring out a high-quality standard on offset, which they have promised to do by the end of this year. They promised before the election to do that. So it's an input to the process of the federal government developing a standard and setting some minimum requirements that these carbon offset retailers should have to meet.
In layman's terms, what are carbon offsets and how can people get involved?
Carbon offset is when you've reduced your own emissions, hopefully, as much as you can through your own efforts and direct changes like reducing your energy consumption, and then you want to completely offset your emissions and go carbon neutral or partially offset them. And how you do that is you pay for emission reductions to be done somewhere else through another project. And this makes sense if the other project is more cost effective than making further reductions yourself, or it's something that's really quite difficult for you to reduce if you have to fly somewhere, for example, and there's not many other options. You pay the carbon offset retailer and they have access to emission reduction projects either in Australia or around the world. It might be a wind farm or it could be an energy efficiency project where they've retrofitted households that's generated some emissions and generated some credits from that, and then you're buying those credits so that you offset your emissions that you've done elsewhere.
You've ranked 20 of Australia's carbon offset retailers. Do you think Australia's standard is matching up globally, and where's room for improvement?
We haven't looked at the standard of international retailers. We've focused very closely on the Australian ones, but some of the Australian ones and the ones that have ranked highly in the assessment have been around for quite a while, and we think are some of the leading organisations in the voluntary carbon market. There's always, of course, opportunities for improvement, and perhaps the biggest opportunity, and this is a little bit outside the control of the retailers, is to tighten up the way that voluntary reductions are accounted for. And at the moment, because we've ratified the Kyoto Protocol, all the reductions that we're currently making through the voluntary market are in some sense reductions that would need to happen anyway to meet that Kyoto target. And so there's a real need for the federal government to put in place a mechanism that separates those voluntary reductions out from the reductions we need to make to meet Kyoto. So that would be the single biggest improvement, I think, that's needed in the Australian market at the moment.
Carbon offsets are only part of the broader challenge of sustainability. Do you think this message is cutting through to the people through your website?
What we've tried to do in our ranking is to... One of the things that we've assessed retailers on is the extent to which they encourage purchasers to actually do things on their own to reduce their emissions before they purchase offsets. So we're very conscious of the fact that we don't want people to just think that they can buy offsets and continue to act in much the same way as they are now and not change their lifestyles at all. So we've given points to organisations that we feel encourage consumers to do more than just offset their emissions. But of course, climate change is only one of many issues that we'd like people to be looking at, and that's what we've focused on. But people really do need to look at ways that they can change their lifestyles to not just reduce their energy use and greenhouse emissions, but their water use and materials use as well.
And that was Dr. Chris Reedy from the Institute for Sustainable Futures speaking to the Third Degree's Anna von Fern. And that website is carbonoffsetwatch.org.au.
Workers in the US are swapping jobs in polluting industries for new green-collar jobs in the emerging clean economy. And in Australia, several pilot programs have started which focus on youth in coal-affected communities like the Hunter Valley. This feature is produced by myself and Holly Cronorn. We speak to program coordinators, young workers, and hear from researchers exploring the potential for green employment.
My father works in a coal-fired power station, and uncle, who's like also pretty much in the exact same field, his son is now just starting in the power station also.
Coal is the biggest single contributor to climate change and carbon dioxide emissions, and in the Hunter, that's a possibility of thousands of new, safe, secure jobs in renewable energy and energy efficiency.
I mean, every job needs to be a green job in the future. Green for all. We don't want to have an eco-elite and an eco-apartheid, essentially.
Australia is addicted to coal. We mine it, we burn it, we export it in incredible amounts. The greenhouse pollution from Australian coal exports eclipses all domestic emissions combined. Many are calling for Australia to kick the coal habit, a call that requires a massive restructure of the economy and export industry, power generation, and a sizeable shift in the job market. Anna Rose, founder of the Australian Youth Climate Coalition and coordinator of their new Green Jobs Initiative, recently returned from the United States, inspired by new pilot programs and what Americans are calling green-collar jobs.
There's a situation in the States where clean tech, renewable energy, energy efficiency, those industries are really booming, but it's also the whitest industry in the States, and there are people who are being left out of this new economy. So the idea with the Oakland Green Jobs Corps is that you're creating good quality, well-paid union jobs, and they'll lead to career paths that will be an alternative to jail, to incarceration, and to a life of poverty.
By green-collar jobs, the Americans mean traditional blue-collar jobs in industries that improve environmental quality. Think solar panel or wind turbine manufacturing, insulating homes, or installing energy-efficient light bulbs.
Australia has the opportunity to be a world leader in renewable energy and in energy efficiency, and that will create hundreds of thousands of jobs. It will create a booming export industry as well in these technologies. So Germany, for example, has 250,000 people employed in renewable energy. We currently don't have the people in Australia that are skilled to do the work we need them to do to save the climate. Like, we meet with wind turbine manufacturers who are saying, actually, we can't employ enough people. We don't have people trained to do this kind of stuff. And then recently I've been talking to a lot of students who are saying, well, we want to go into the green economy, but we don't know where to go. Like, there's a disconnect there. There's no such thing currently as a green careers fair that you can actually match up your career ambition with all the employers.
This lack of training and job opportunities is a gap many young workers are facing, particularly those in coal communities. Blythe Twyford Moore is 18 and living on the central coast of New South Wales. He works at a construction site building turbines for a new power station. His dad, his uncle and cousin all work in power generation, but Blythe wishes there were other opportunities.
I really would have preferred it for, like, the moral benefits. I kind of see this counterproductive to build something that has a limit to it. Natural gas or coal, they can only last so long, and we're building these massive multi-million dollar projects just to run themselves into the ground. When stuff runs out, I'd heaps prefer to be doing something that's innovative.
Bly rides his bike, powers his band by solar panels, and he's ditching the power station job to study photovoltaic engineering at the University of New South Wales next year.
We had the harebrained scheme to rig our band off solar power. The intention was to be carbon neutral, but also to promote awareness about carbon neutrality and how it's really possible just to do it with a homemade box full of batteries and stuff. We have this, like, battery rig that we made, consisting of two car batteries that hook into a solar panel. Solar Sonics is what we called our wheelie battery outfit. I'm a heap strong believer in this impending environmental apocalypse, and I'm just trying to do what I can to have my conscience clean.
In the next couple of months, the first Australian green job creation pilot projects are getting underway in Melbourne, Adelaide, Western Sydney and the Hunter Valley. Project coordinators are searching for young people like Bly. Leslie Tobin from the Dusseldorp Skills Forum is managing three new projects aimed at training and supporting young people for new jobs for a sustainable economy.
Wygreen is looking to replicate, adapt something that we saw working in California with the California Youth Services. The young people there during their school holiday time go out and work with households to replace light bulbs and shower heads. In South Australia, there's a real keenness to train up young people while they're still at school. And so we're looking at that as a potential model. In Victoria, there's a model where they're looking at working with disadvantaged young people in an eco-centre and having that as the basis for expansion.
But there are significant political and social barriers for the shift to green jobs. They are barriers Jeff Evans knows well. As a University of Newcastle academic, completing a PhD on future transitions for coal communities to a sustainable economy.
Newcastle and the Lower Hunter is underlaid by vast beds of high-quality black coal. As the industry has grown, the scale of mines has grown too, from originally mostly underground mines to being vast open-cut mines, such as the Mount Arthur mine near Muswellbrook, which is 40 square kilometres in size, so it's massive. Some mine workers have referred to the phenomena of the golden handcuffs, where workers are paid a lot of money but are locked into really unsatisfying and unhealthy jobs. Many people, if they had a choice, would rather not work in mining if there were better options, safer, more secure, well-paid and union jobs in other industries.
Green Jobs pilot programs aim to create handfuls of these jobs to show the shift is possible. But we're not on the road yet. The Rudd government's first budget delivered a blow for the solar industry, means testing the solar rebate, slashing at least 70% of orders and 400 jobs. Climate advocates like Jeff are detailing strategic paths to wean us off our coal dependency.
Government needs to drive that process. It needs to encourage investment in new industries. It has to invest in retraining and education of workers and the community to develop the skills to take up new employment opportunities. And in the Hunter, that's a possibility of thousands of new, safe, secure jobs in renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies, which would revitalise the region's manufacturing industry. That's the hope that many people in the community have and the vision that they have as the Hunter, as a clean energy centre of the future.
But some are too impatient to wait for pilot schemes, 30-year transition strategies or for governments to begin moving on green jobs. On graduating in renewable energy engineering, there were so few jobs that Maurice Wells just created some himself. At 23, Maurice established the Sydney Energy Cooperative and began installing solar power, changing light bulbs, and educating people on climate change solutions.
So, here's our layout.
Now, the roof is very high, which is good, 6 metres. So, 10 panels is 8.5 metres, 8 panels is 6.8 metres. So.
What we spend most of our time on is installations of solar panels onto people's homes. So it is manual work. The engineering part of it is very simple. At the end of the day, like, today, I just feel physically exhausted, but as the days or weeks go by, I can look back and go, wow, we've last week put in 5 kilowatts of solar panels. Definitely get a sense of satisfaction that what I've been doing makes a positive difference.
Other renewable energy graduates have vied for university research positions or moved into energy efficient design, but half are working generic engineering jobs in large energy companies.
The proportion of renewable energy in Australia's electricity grid is very small. As a result, the number of jobs from Energy Australia that would have something to do with renewable energy at the moment are quite small. So a lot of people are taking this. I think they hope to get more experience to go for positions that make better use of their skills.
The challenge of curing Australia's coal addiction is huge, but we are finally beginning. First, with green jobs pilot programs. Next, beginning to retrain workers for green collar jobs. And soon, creating strategies for a just transition to ensure no one is left out of the new, sustainable economy.
It's also something that I think politicians inherently, it's going to be hard for them to say no to, because it's green, which is now politically popular, and it's jobs, which is always politically popular.
I think the biggest barrier to shift to a green economy for Australia and renewable energy and energy efficiency is the power of the coal industry.
The more green your industry is, the more likely you're going to be able to continue to keep your job, and the less likely that you're going to be shut down just because some reality's kicking in. You can't keep polluting CO2 forever and think the world's going to hack it.
And the reporter you were listening to there is Holly Crinoan. This has been The Third Degree with Jessica Minchell
and Libby King. And next week, our guest is Adam Wolfenden from AfterNet, who will be chatting to about globalization, trade, and Battle in Seattle, the new blockbuster film depicting the 1999 Seattle protests against the WTO.
You can listen to a podcast of this week's stories as well as previous shows, and they're linked from our 2SER website.
Yep, and we've also got the links to the addresses of some of the groups that we talked about and things that are coming up in relation to the intervention that we spoke about today. And please send any feedback or story ideas to the third degree at 2ser.com. That's third with the number 3.
See you next week.